Since 1960, man has been sending missions to Mars. Some successes, others failures. But that hasn't stopped scientists from trying to explore the red planet. So how do you design a device that's able to stand up to the hundreds of millions of kilometers to Mars and yet be sensitive enough to, say, measure the wind? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and on this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we are asking, how do you make scientific equipment space-proof? To answer this big question, I caught up with Colin Wilson. His journey to space hasn't been a smooth one. We met at a wind tunnel he uses at the University of Oxford to test his equipment. And today, they are trying to plug a leak.
And it's proving a little bit temperamental, but we're trying to make it work.
Colin works in the atmospheric physics department at the University of Oxford. And he's curious about what the atmosphere on Mars is doing.
So there's several reasons we're interested in the weather on Mars, the atmospheric circulation on Mars. One is scientific. We're trying to figure out what drives atmospheric processes on Mars, what drives climate on Mars. Mars today is cold and dry, but in the past, there must have been huge amounts of water on Mars. We can see canyons bigger than the Grand Canyon on Earth, which were carved by water. Where has all that water gone? So to understand these processes, we need to measure what the atmosphere is doing today to try to figure out what it was doing in the past.
So back when he was a PhD student, he came up with an idea. The types of weather stations that we use here on Earth aren't going to cut it on Mars. So he needed to think outside of the box when it came to measuring the wind.
On Mars, the atmosphere is much thinner than it is on Earth. So even if the wind's blowing 100 kilometers an hour, you would barely feel it because there's so few molecules in the air. It doesn't exert much force. So spinning cup anemometers are out. Another way you might measure wind or see if it's windy is by licking your finger and holding it up in the air. Now, what that does is your finger is heated. And so if the wind blows and cools your finger, you can feel that, and that tells you where the wind's coming from and how strong it is. That's what we do with our little wind sensor. It has three heaters on either sides of it, and we heat them up and see how warm they get. The faster the wind is blowing, the less warm they get. It's that simple.
The first mission to come along for Colin was the British lander Beagle 2. Its mission? To find life on Mars, past or present. It was set to land on Mars on Christmas Day in 2003, and it happened to be in the market for a wind sensor. Colin had two key specifications. It had to be ready in half a year, and it had to be cheap.
Well, so no money was actually quite useful as a boundary condition, because it meant that I couldn't go all exotic in terms of solutions I was proposing. Basically, anything we were proposing had to be feasible on-site in our own workshops using kit we could find or make relatively cheaply. So that made it really simple. And so, first of all, I looked around to find some expertise within the university. And it turns out that in the engineering science department, they've been building heat transfer gauges for many decades, and they have some real expertise, and also technicians who can build these things in-house. So that was on the cars. That was something we could propose.
Allumage Vulcan.
The launch went perfectly, but when Beagle 2 attempted to land on Mars, things went wrong. The European Space Agency didn't receive any contact from the spacecraft, and in February 2004, they declared the mission lost.
Well, Beagle 2, we always knew, was a high-risk mission. It was a very small lander trying to achieve a lot. It had a huge amount of scientific instrumentation on it. And its parachutes and its airbags and all the systems it needed for landing were not massively oversized, shall we say. You know, you have an estimate of how big a parachute you need, and maybe you can make your parachute 10% bigger or something, but that doesn't leave you a lot of margin for error. And so somewhere in that entry process, when Beagle 2 arrives at the top of the atmosphere at 20,000 kilometers an hour and then has to slow down, jettison its heat shield, you know, deploy its parachute, inflate its airbags, bounce, unfold on the surface. Somewhere in that whole process, something went wrong. In fact, 10 years after the landing, we think we've seen pictures of Beagle 2 on the surface, apparently successfully deployed with almost all of its solar panels unfurled, which suggests that it got almost all the way, that it landed safely, started unfolding its solar panels, and then something got stuck. So it came tantalizingly close to actually sending back that data, but didn't. Does that make us feel better, you know, after the fact? Maybe a little bit.
And while Colin got his PhD out of it, it was a small consolation. His wind sensor was gone, but not forgotten.
But so, cut to the future. I've now been researching other planets, Venus in particular, for the last 10 years, but keeping an eye on Mars. And so when the next opportunity came up to put a wind sensor on a Mars lander, we were there with the Beagle 2 wind sensor, which had built some time ago. We said, look, you can have this one again for close to no money. They like that sort of thing. So we provided the same wind sensor again for this mission, which takes about 4 years of planning and rebuilding and doing new documentation.
And there are a lot of boxes that you need to tick to get a project into space. First, you need to prove that it's not going to break. If it's on an old Soviet cargo rocket like Colin's sensor was, it is a bumpy ride to Mars. So they'll put the sensor on a vibration table to simulate the shaking to make sure that it can withstand force. Also, they have to make sure that it can stand up to the vacuum of space. For example, plastics are volatile. You don't want to build something that's going to melt or come apart. So they have to pick the right materials. Then there is radiation testing. You have to make sure that the electronics can survive radiation damage. And then there is the small matter of planetary protection.
Last thing you want to do when you go to Mars is contaminate it with life from Earth. It's likely that anything you bring from Earth is not going to thrive on Mars, so you don't have to necessarily worry about mosses from Earth spreading across Mars. But at the same time, if you have very sensitive life detection equipment and you go to Mars and you detect, for example, a flu germ, then you don't want that to have been the flu germ which came from a technician who sneezed on it on Earth. So for that reason, everything we go to Mars has to be sterilized. So we bake most things at 125 degrees centigrade, which will kill all your bugs. But that's not enough, because you're still sending dead bugs and dead germs to Mars. So we have to assemble everything in a very clean environment, clean room, so that you don't get those dead bugs on Mars in the first place.
And with all his T's crossed and his I's dotted, Colin got his sensor, a project now 17 years in the making, onto the 2016 ExoMars rocket. And he waited anxiously with probably all of his fingers crossed.
Welcome to the Space Operations Center of the European Space Agency, ESA, here in Darmstadt, Germany. After a seven-month journey through space, covering a distance of 496 million kilometers, the ESA's ExoMars spacecraft and lander have both arrived at their final destination. That is our mysterious neighbor planet.
We'd all gone to ESA Mission Control to be there to look at the first data when it came back. And so we could see that on screen a little spike of the radio signal, so we can track the radio signal as the lander went down.
We can confirm that the maneuver is started.
And we could watch it go through the atmosphere. We saw that it successfully managed to decelerate through the high speed portion of its entry. It successfully managed to deploy its parachute. The radio signal was still there. It was coming down to the time it was going to land on the surface, and then suddenly the radio signal disappeared. It's not a good sign, but the first thing we all do is try to figure out what's going on. You try to think of what scenarios there might be. You know, what's gone wrong? What scenarios are there where something's gone wrong? You know, maybe the computer's just got a bit of a knock and needs to reboot. And so you ask about that, and someone says, oh, no, it's not possible, given the computer, and things like this. So the first thing you do is try to figure out what's wrong. But yes, then once you figure out that there are no good scenarios, then it's pretty disappointing. On the one hand, most people in the control room that day were relatively happy, because most of the science return from this mission, in fact, is from the orbiter. So there's an orbiter which also carried this entry probe to Mars, and that orbiter went into orbit successfully and is going to deliver great science. And in terms of the lander was in fact a technology demonstrator to test the technologies needed for safe landing on Mars. And it transmitted lots of data back during its entry. So we have lots of data on the successful high-speed entry. We have lots of data on the successful parachute deployment and descent. And we even have data from the firing of the rockets in the final stage, although that went wrong. So we have data from each of those phases of the descent. So it's a partial success. It's just a bit unfortunate for those of us who are waiting for safe landed operations.
Colin is taking this setback in stride. He says he can't carry all your eggs in one basket when it comes to space. So in the meantime, while he figures out the next steps for his wind sensor, he's turning his attention to Venus.
We've been trying to get missions flown to Venus, which is like Mars. It's a sibling planet of Earth. Mars, Venus, and Earth were formed at a similar sort of time in history out of similar materials. So we're trying to chart how it was that these planets evolved differently. So we're now putting in mission proposals for missions which might fly in 10, 15 years. Now that sounds like a long time away, but not only do the scientists have to get the instruments ready and tested and checked and redesigned, but the space agencies need to line up the funding.
And hopefully one day his wind sensor will get off the ground and onto Mars.
We know it's a high-risk field. You know, rocket science is not easy. We do it not because it's easy, but because the rewards are high, the risks are high and the rewards are high.
This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks for the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons. And a special thanks to Dr. Colin Wilson and the European Space Agency. Tell us what you think about this podcast. You can go to Twitter and tweet us at Oxford Sparks. You can find us on Facebook. And of course, we have a website. Who doesn't have a website? It is oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. I'm Emily Elias. And next time on the podcast, we are looking at Kim Kardashian. Yes, that Kim Kardashian. And we are asking, how do we keep our social media obsession from making us a target for crime? Bye for now.